Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Marla Frazee, illustrator, author, channeling her inner five-year-old to shout out in safety and with great exuberance. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 304 of the podcast with Marla Frazee. Marla was the last person I spoke with prior to the 2016 elections and is the first interview I'm sharing following the election results. Fitting, I think, because our conversation focuses on the themes of bringing children into the world and the demands they present, as well as the honesty and enthusiasm with which most children talk. The books we're talking about here are Is Mommy? And The Bossier Baby, which is a sequel to The Boss Baby. Both books bring a huge smile to my face. I'm thinking that might just be the thing you're looking for as you listen. So, please do enjoy the time you spend with Marla and me as you listen to today's episode. Here's episode number 304 of the podcast with Marla Frazee. Welcome to the podcast, Marla Frazee. I've waited a long time to talk to you. I'm glad we're here.
Hi, Matthew. I'm just so happy to be talking to you.
Marla, you have made a lot of amazing books, but there's a lot of things that brought me to you, huh? Because I was saying to you before recording that Steve Malk brought me to you because I didn't realize that he was your agent, and I had a moment where I was like, you know her?
Well, Steve has been my agent for quite some time. I was really lucky to start working with him when he was just at the beginning of his career, and I was sort of into mine for a while and really needed and wanted an agent. So it was very fortuitous, and I'm just so happy that we have been able to work together. It's been great.
How did you start working with him? I know that he worked out of his parents, like, owned a bookstore for a while, and he met a lot of people through that, and then something brought him into publishing. But do you live around him, or was it a connection somewhere online somehow?
It was through the SCBWI. Well, actually, I talked to him quite a few times at the SCBWI National Conference in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But it was actually Peggy Rathman that put me in touch with Steve.
Really?
It was.
Officer Buckle fame?
Yes.
Nice.
And she must have, I'm not exactly sure if she had just been down to the store and had met him through, you know, the White Rabbit in La Jolla, but I also live in Southern California, so I had, you know, been down there and had done a few signings. And I was at the time publishing with Harcourt, and they were down in San Diego.
Nice.
But it was pretty much Peggy that said, you really need to talk to Steve Malk. He's this young guy, and he's just starting out, and, you know, as an agent. And as soon as Steve and I got on the telephone, I felt that we, you know, just connected on books and kids and reading and all the kinds of things that, you know, are important to me and are important to him.
Yeah, he's a very sweet guy. As we'd said before, I've talked to him twice now, and I was just excited to have somebody to nerd out over music with. It's usually like between he and Greg Pizzoli. We have a lot of we share a lot of past music. It's great.
We could
trade 45s and singles and stuff like that. You know, because growing up in the punk scene, you see the revival of all of the 7 inches and stuff. So it's great.
Right. Well, he's great talking about things like that.
Yeah, and then from there, in the time that I've talked to him, I saw this gorgeous video that was produced with you in your studio. That was amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I
by you that know, that point, came about in such an interesting way because I have lived in the house I live in since 1986. It's been quite some time. And raised 3 sons here, and they're now grown. And I was just in a place where I really wanted to have a little free library in my front yard. And so I drew one, and this man who builds very large buildings and such actually built it. It was probably the smallest structure he's ever built. And it's really cute. And so, you know, I started to meet neighbors who come by, and there was this man that came by with his son named Adam, and we were just talking, and his son was like very, you know, into looking at the books in the little free library. And then something clicked with Adam, and he may have already been saying something. I had an All the World in the library, and he looked at it and he said, "I love this book, and I hear that, you know, the illustrator lives in in Pasadena." And
he was like,
"Wait,
really?"
He put it together. He's like, wait, is that you? And I said, "Yeah." So he then told me, "That's so strange, because I wanted to contact you, you know, about doing this documentary. I really, you know, he works at Disney. This is a passion of his to do, you know, film documentaries, and he wanted to start doing that." And Whoa. He asked me if I was willing to do it, and I was sure. So that's how it all happened.
Marla, I have chills from that he was just like taking a tour of the little free library. Yeah. That's unbelievable. That is crazy, and it's awesome. Well, you know what though? I gotta be honest. Your books are everywhere, and that's a really good thing. Like, we have a 19-month-old, and in the time that, you know, I've been a librarian and I've been aware of the names that are printed on books, I've come to recognize names coming up and coming up again. And your name comes up all the time in our little board book collection.
Nice.
And all of our students know you, not just because your books have been on our State Book Award in Maryland, but also because The Farmer and the Clown was a book that our kids obsessed over when we did our mock Caldecott. Last year, a couple years ago, it was one of those, like, to have kids pore over your art, to have them study your technique. It's just, I don't know, it's a neat thing. You get to know, I feel like we got to know you intimately without knowing you intimately, but we probably...
Oh, well, that's a huge compliment.
We probably did though, right? Because you pour yourself onto the page.
Well, I do. I try to. And, you know, one of the things that you said makes, it just touches on the fundamental reason that I wanted to do this in the first place, which is, you know, kids pore over pictures and they read them in a way that adults, you know, I think don't, to be perfectly honest. I just think, you know, once we learn how to read words, we're sort of off and running on words, and they just sort of take over in a way. And the kids who haven't learned how to read words yet, they're really looking at the pictures in a completely different and much more intense way. And so doing that book, a wordless book, it was the first time I had actually done a wordless book. I just love hearing that they were poring over the pictures, but I'm not that surprised by it, because it is, you know, actually the reason I wanted to do picture books in the first place.
Was that book always wordless?
You know, no. I mean, I didn't think it was going to be wordless until I started to actually put something down on paper. And once I started to do that, you know, it was almost like a little film strip in my head, the beginning part. I didn't know how it was going to resolve, but I started to draw this, the beginning. And I thought, as soon as I started to do that, I think it was mainly because the relationship between the farmer and the clown was very nonverbal and really about the way they perceived each other. And then also were sort of duped into thinking the other one was feeling the way that they, you know, a different way than they actually were. I felt like that whole scenario was better told as a wordless book because it would also dawn on the reader in the same way it sort of dawned on them.
Yeah.
And so really early on in the process, it became a wordless book. And when I showed it to my editor, who I've worked with on most of the picture books I've done, it's Alan Johnston of Beach Lane. She immediately kind of got it. And she had never done a wordless book as an editor either. And so it was a really fun project. It was an emotional project for me. Like, I was in it before I realized sort of how much it resonated in my life at the time.
Well, so there's these great things that you mention that are pulled off so exquisitely in the book. The fact that you have, the fact that you've selected these characters that almost are by their nature wordless in the way that we know them, you know, and an older farmer gentleman is quiet and sticks to his work. Clowns we know for being silent and communicating through their actions. And then you bring up too the way that this story sort of planted itself in your brain as if it was a film. And I think that there's the beauty of wordless books, and probably also why the children pored over it as much as they did, because as you flip through that book, it is cinematic. Your eyes guide the camera through the page, and it's a movie through your illustration. So I think all of that makes sense. I think if there were words in there, it would have interrupted the flow. It would have interrupted what the children were getting out of it.
Well, thanks.
Oh, by the way, who am I talking? Yeah. What the children are getting out of it. I loved that book too. Let's not even try to hide that. I nerd out as good as the rest of them on any good book. And that is one that I was like, come on, you have to love this so that we can have a connection.
Well, and that's just the best thing about you. I mean, I've listened to so many of your podcasts and I just love the way you talk about books and the enthusiasm you generate for, you know, the process of.
I don't shy away from it. I don't know how y'all do what you do, but I sure love what you do.
Thanks. You know, that book, I was sort of obsessing over clowns for a while before the idea came to me. Not because I like clowns. In fact, I don't like clowns.
No,
but
thank you. My aunt obsessed over clowns. And I remember visiting her house in Florida and having like, she just had porcelain clowns everywhere. She probably still does. But
that's scary.
It was not a great feeling. No.
Yeah. And especially, you know, now we have clowns in the news.
I know.
Weird things. But somehow there was just a time I had seen a clown show at a high school and I was sort of obsessed with story about a clown. And but nothing was really clicking until just one day I saw that clown as a baby clown holding the hand of sort of a stern, tall, thin farmer. And then it was, you know, that was the click. And I thought, what are they doing together? Like, why are these two characters together, you know? And so that was the question that led to the book. And then it just sort of emerged from that.
And I love it. I mean, I love the way that your silhouette in those two characters, for me, and this brings up those sorts of questions too. It reminded me of H.A. Rey. It reminded me of the silhouette of the man with the yellow hat in Curious George. Just you're looking at them and it just evokes questions in you. And so you
know,
open the book to see.
It probably was. Now that you say that, I would bet.
Oh, that's just amazing.
There was something there because I loved that book. And like just that holding of the hand of Curious George. And yes, I never thought of it until you just said it. But wow.
It's
That's
beautiful.
fascinating.
It's, well, whatever's going on in the back of your head with that. I mean, we read these things and they stick with us, right? That's why when children read your books, why when we all read everyone's books, we get out of them what we do, and why some books connect with others more deeply, because we, you know, you write the book, but we pour ourselves into the book, right? So there's this connection here that,
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
So you've got these two books coming out. So I should say to preface that you met Danielle. Danielle Smith is my agent. She's an agent. And she met you. And I'm saying that to contextualize this for the listeners because one of your books that is now out or about to come out, doesn't matter, is one that she's like, okay, you need to talk to Marla about this book. And when I got it, you said about how children see books differently than adults do, and how words take on different meaning and stories, whatever. We're going to get to it. The two books I have to talk to you about tonight are The Bossier Baby, wonderful,
uh-huh.
And we'll talk about Alec Baldwin and all that goodness,
uh-huh.
And nice. Is Mommy. So,
ah.
Marla, I'm going to pitch it to you. Where do you want to start? I'm excited about both. I'll happy to go wherever.
Let's start with Is Mommy, because
Believe.
it came out before The Bossier Baby, and it's a book that is not everyone's cup of tea. Let's just put it that way.
All right, so it's out. How are you sharing, when people ask what is Mommy, how are you like book talking it?
Well, it's hard to book talk a book if you're the person that is sort of someone who's made the book, but the text is by a poet named Victoria Chang, and it is a very honest, in my mind, questioning of how very young children feel about their mommy, and asking if they, you know, a positive and a negative, and they are all like very exuberantly, and I think with great safety around, you know, the ability to be able to shout out the negative answer, just shouting out the negative answer. And so Mommy's kind of come off being not entirely, you know, positive. And yet that is, you know, how we often feel about the people we love the most. And I thought what I loved about it was that this book was, I felt, could give children the sort of, you know, permission to actually, you know, have a safe place to voice, oh, that's funny. It's funny to feel that way, but it's not doing anybody any harm. And actually, we love our mommies just so. This is part of what makes them our mommies. And so I think it's hilarious. I mean, I know as a mommy, I knew, you know, my kids were thinking not entirely positive things about me quite often, and still don't. And
If you don't mind, I'd love to read it, an excerpt of the text.
Okay.
And then I want to tell you a story about my son. Can I do both of those? I'm going to do both of those. Here we go. So it just starts. I should say on each page, we meet a different child and their mom. And as you said, there's a sort of a question that is answered with a positive or a negative. So the title page just says, Is Mommy? Question mark. And we start off with a girl asking, Is Mommy what? Is Mommy tall or short? And then, of course, short! Is Mommy pretty or ugly? And laughing, ugly! So we have a 6-year-old and a 19-month-old. And I gave this to Amy, to my wife, and she read it and thought it was the greatest. And then our son is learning to read independently, and he's doing better, and now we're starting to hand him picture books and be like, read this to us. And he, oh, do I have to? Yeah, please, you're going to be able to read it. I gave him this book, and he was hysterical in his eyes, Marla. I'm sure you've read it around children before, but his eyes were like, can I read this? And when the word shouted out, he every time I looked at mommy and smiled. It was an experience that I know drew them closer. It was wonderful. The story is so truthful, and the way you chose to illustrate it just works. You see the kids, it's a mirror. They see themselves reflected in these characters.
Oh, well, thank you. I love that story. I just love that. You know, when Alan received this text, and she has said this, we have told this story publicly, so I don't think I'm saying anything out of school, because she sent it to me and she said, get a load of this. And I think she really thought I was going to say, oh boy, you know, your job is so hard. But I said, wow, that there's something there. There's absolutely something there. And we just kept talking about it. But Victoria, she had submitted it to Alan, and then she pulled it. So maybe, I don't know how long after she had submitted it, she pulled it back. But Alan and I would talk about this thing for years, you know?
For years.
And I'd say things like, you know, there's something there, but I don't know if I'm the right one to illustrate. Somebody could do it. I don't know if it's me. And then there was just a point where it was just like, snap. I thought, you know, I think I could do it if I did it with tempera paint on manila paper and just sort of channeled my, you know, inner kindergarten, like, art person, and just, you know, the little five-year-old I was when I was painting that way. And I actually tried to do it in a much more, you know, like sort of easel painting if I, you know, were a kindergartner kind of way. And it was such a mess in my, it was like, I couldn't control anything. and so then I kind of reined that in a little bit. But it was trickier than I thought it was. You know, there, like, each of those words, like, is mommy, you know, pretty or ugly or nice or mean? You know, there were a couple stanzas that were different, like strong or weak. And, like, that was not, no one wants to think of their mommy as weak, you know?
Yeah.
So it just didn't work. The ugly one was, it had to really be gentle, you know, and young, old, it gentle. So it was just sort of a flip side that was more, I wanted it also to have a tenderness. And I feel like in some of those cases, there is a tenderness, like the mommy's kind of just getting up in the one where she's ugly, which, you know, quite frankly, we all feel and look not so great in those moments. And, you know, and then the young old, like, she had just tried to do a somersault and, you know, she's crank, you know, she's sore and a little bit, and the child is a little concerned, like, oh, are you okay? And then toward the end, you know, when they're asked if they love their mommy, by that time, they're just sort of over it. They're kind of, their attention is, I tried to indicate, like, sort of more on the cupcakes than on the mommy at that point. So,
yeah, do you love do you love your short, ugly, mean, boring, old, messy mommy? Yeah.
Yeah, but we want this cupcake more.
I have to say that I think the other part that my son loved about this is that, I'm going to word this the right way, but you used his favorite curse word, or Victoria used his favorite curse word, which is that when he gets angry, that boy likes to call things boring. This is boring. This is so boring. Mommy, you're boring. And when he read that, it was like, I'm reading a bad word.
That's adorable.
I know, right?
Yeah. You know, I was just at Once Upon a Time in Montrose, in California, like, doing a book signing, the first one for the Boss Year Baby. And there was a kid that came in. He was probably, I don't know, maybe 8. And, you know, when he walked in, he sort of wandered in the bookstore, and everybody there that worked there said, oh yeah, here's Thomas. He's a regular, you know. And, hey, Thomas, this is Marla Frazee. She did these books. And he kind of, his eyes looked at the ones on the table, and then he saw his mommy and he just lit up and said, oh, did you do that one? I said, I did. I love that book.
Oh.
My mom, he goes, my mom, not so much, but I love it. So I took his picture with the book, and, you know, I mean, this book to me is a real clear example of, you know, who are we publishing these books for? In this case, I was really going for the kids, you know. This wasn't to make mommies feel better about being mommies. This was for the kids to kind of, I felt to, as I said, just sort of give them a place in which they can, there's like a comfort around, okay, yeah, even though you might have these feelings, it's okay. You know, these feelings are okay. They don't hurt anybody to have them. And, you know, I think that's really important.
I think that that's important too, creating that safe space where we can acknowledge that you're not bad for having these feelings. And in fact, it's sometimes we can laugh about how silly they are.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, to go from that, then I feel like that's a great transition into Bossier Baby, because how much as a parent do I see myself in this, especially again, having a boy and then a girl around the house that's just a wonderful, beautiful terror at all hours. And I think I read, was it in PW? Not I think I read. I did read. I just don't remember where it was. That story you wrote about really not knowing whether or not there was a second book here, if there was a sequel to Boss Baby.
Yeah, I never intended that there would be. Like I had, you know, the Boss Baby came out in 2010, so it's been around a while, and people have suggested sequels over the years, and I've thought, yeah, whatever. Like, in fact, I remember a number of people saying you should do a Boss That's a Girl, you know, way early, and you know, when Boss Baby was Boss Baby, and I wasn't thinking of a sequel. It just didn't feel right to me. Like I felt like the thing about Boss Baby was that he was a white male stereotypical boss in much the way of like those old TV shows that I grew up with in the 50s that just had that sort of, you know, generic character. Like I thought of him in that regard. So the idea of, you know, I really have over the years that I've been working, like been tried to be as aware as I possibly can of, you know, sort of having a lot of diversity in my books. But in this case, it was a white male stereotypical boss for a reason. Like I thought it was funnier. And I sort of, that's why I set it in sort of a mid-century kind of TV land. I didn't really feel like this was real life. And so then, you know, it was optioned by DreamWorks Animation, which was incredible. And, you know, I thought that was such a wonderful piece of news, but didn't really believe that it would become a film. Like, you know,
things get optioned, right? Like, that's a thing. Things get optioned. They don't always get made.
No, they don't always get made. And so even as it was sort of coming along, I would hear things, and DreamWorks has been so, you know, generous about inviting me to the studio and showing me things as it has gone on. But in fact, you know, there was this big kind of gift basket, like, we're in production. I was like, really? What is that? What does that mean? Oh, is that good? Okay, great. Oh, wow. So anyway, it's coming closer and closer to the release. It's just amazing. And it was a year ago last August. So August of 15, I was on vacation with my whole extended family. We always go to the beach in this beach house we all stay in. It's great. And so it was that week, and I got a text from Steve Malk, and he said in the text, Alex, his wife, thinks you should do a sequel to The Boss Baby, but with a little girl. And, you know, Steve and Alex have a boss of their own named Sylvie.
I've seen pictures of Sylvie, yeah.
Yes. And so perhaps she had something to do with this. But, you know, I kind of thought, oh, yeah, that would be funny. And, yeah, but, you know, I didn't think I was really going to think about it. And then I went for a long walk on the beach, and I didn't have the Boss Baby to, like, really look at or, you know, but I was just sort of thinking about it, and somehow the voice kind of came back to me, and I, a first sentence popped into my mind, and so I took out my phone and wrote it down on like the little note thing, and then I'd walk some more in another sentence, and by the end of the day, I had sort of enough of a something. I wouldn't call it the text, but I had enough of a something that it was like something I could show to Steve and to Alan, and we were all kind of like, hey, this could be a sequel. And so I think the time was right. Obviously, we have, hopefully, we're heading toward the first female president of the United States.
We'll know by the time this publishes. We are the, for those listening, we are the day before election. Marla said specifically, oh, Matthew, we can't record on Tuesday. That we can't do that.
I'm so anxious. I'm wearing my Hillary shirt. But, so I, you know, I think it's just the time is, this is, it's time for this little girl boss to be coming into this mid-century house and sort of shaking it up. And, yeah. And so I'm excited about this. It's really fun to have the sequel and this film and, you
when
know.
When does the film come out?
Comes out in March.
In March, so it's coming. Yeah.
It's coming. And in fact, a number of people who have seen Trolls, which just released, it's preceded by the trailer of The Boss Baby.
Okay, so the trailer.
I think people say, like, I just saw the trailer. So
yeah, I'll put it in the show notes so people can see it. If that's launched, then yeah, it's
oh yeah, it's a real launched. Thing. It's very funny.
With that's so. Why I brought up before with Alec Baldwin as the Boss Baby. Come on.
Steve and I early on were invited to DreamWorks to see, you know, just it was maybe about in total 20 to 30 minutes of the film. At various stages of, you know, being worked on. So there are a couple places where it seemed very finished and then others that was still in sketches. And but we did see this part where, you know, the Alec Baldwin's voice comes out of this character of the Boss Baby. And afterwards, like, I feel like we both staggered off the DreamWorks lot and then didn't talk to each other for a few hours. And when we did, it was kind of like, was that a dream? Did that really happen? That was unbelievable. Blew my mind, you know? And I kept thinking that might have not really happened. Like it was too surreal.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, from the way you start, I'm sure your first sentence has changed slightly since then, since that walk on the beach, but the line that opens this, from the moment his baby sister arrived, the Boss Baby had a feeling that change was in the air. That line, and a couple pages later, when we learned that the Boss Baby was demoted the new baby, she promoted herself to chief executive officer. I love the line, the CEO was bossier than the Boss Baby had ever been, which seems impossible. And you've got that drawing with just her two little chiclet teeth coming out from the bottom. It's perfect.
Well, I wanted her to arrive. You know, the Boss Baby arrives in a taxi, you know, a checker cab with his huge briefcase that's full of paper. And I thought, well, she needs to kind of have an updated version of this. So it's more of a town car. And she has a tablet, which is her Etch-a-Sketch. And so it's a little streamlined from his. And I kind of wanted her to sort of hold it like we would hold a device. But, you know, it still is set in this period of time that in my mind. That's
I love it. Every time I look at your books, I love to stare at your characters. You draw characters so beautifully. Do you have a background in animation or maybe you just are drawn to the human figure? There's just something about how expressive your characters always are.
Well, thank you. I have always loved drawing people the most. And I went to Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, and I had a lot of life drawing, and I still love to do that if I can. I feel like it's like a great tune-up. Mm. But I do love animation. And as soon as I graduated, I graduated on a Friday, and on Monday I started working at Disney in the story department. And I was hired, I don't know why I was hired, because I had zero animation experience. But they put me into this department. And I worked with some really amazing people who have gone on to do really amazing movies for Disney. But I lasted for 6 weeks there because I didn't, number one, know what to do. I mean, I just didn't know what I was doing there. And there was this kind of culture of the people that worked there. Most of them had gone to Cal Arts. They knew a lot about animation. Of course, they were trained in animation. And so, I mean, just as a fan, that was one thing. But to actually do it in any kind of way was a whole other thing. And I knew eventually I wanted to do children's books, and I just left after 6 weeks and started a freelance. And then I did all kinds of illustration just to make, you know, to pay the bills, you know, as I went through the whole jumping through the hoops of getting published, which took about a decade almost to do the kind of books that I hope to do, you know. So, you know, I did all kinds of other work at the getting to that point. And a lot of it was sort of close to what I wanted to do, which would be, you know, a lot of educational material and stuff like advertising for kids. But, you know, it was not where my heart was. So it wasn't until, you know, it took a while. And then I started to finally get the kind of picture books that I was wanting to do. So, you know, I don't have one of those stories where, and then I just got published, you know. It took a while.
Well, I'm grinning ear for ear because for me, where your story is now is, and then Marla Frazee took up a huge section in our library. and that's a wonderful thing. I mean, you're in libraries, you're in little, you know, our little libraries in bedrooms, and you're gifted at baby showers, and you've got your art is everywhere, and your readers are really up close with it. So that is such an amazing thing, and I'm so grateful, Marla, that you're in the world making what you are, because I love it, and it's something that not only reflects back my childhood, but reflects the life of my kids and the students that I teach too when I read it. So you're giving a lot in your art. I'm grateful for that.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, when you said that about the libraries, and, you know, when I just was flashing on my own, you know, 8-year-old self going to the public library with my mom and my siblings and just sort of being let loose, and I would gravitate toward the picture books, and they were low to the ground because those readers are short. And I would sit on the floor and just pull these books out, and I was already reading words, but I just remember when I first encountered Where the Wild Things Are, and it literally threw me back on my bottom. I was so floored by the magic of it. And I just remember, you know, that feeling of, oh my God, like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Like, I want to learn how to do this. And so and I just have not ever changed my mind about that. I feel so lucky to be able to, you know, work in this field and be able to tell stories in this genre, just in this form. I think it's amazing.
Well, I hope you never, ever, ever change your mind.
Thank you, Matt.
Marla, we've come back full circle back to the children. So I want to close by giving you the final word. And I want to ask you about really all children, but I'm going to ask you about my students. I'm going to see a library full of my children soon. What message can I bring to them from you?
Oh boy. You know, to go play outside, to spend time outside. I think that's the most important thing that all of us can do. It doesn't matter what our age is, but, you know, whether we're sitting under a tree like Ferdinand or actually running around or walking somewhere or just, you know, breathing the air, I just think it returns us to ourselves.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Candace Fleming and Eric Roman share Giant Squid, their newest picture book together. Plus, Candy talks about Presenting Buffalo Bill, the man who invented the Wild West, her newest novel. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep and I'll see you there.